Okay, good morning, everyone. Let's find a seat, and let's get rocking and rolling here. So, cool. Everybody visiting. So, my name is Tom, and it's a joy to be with you again. I was here about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I think, something like that. And I was thinking about what I was trying to remember what I said a couple of weeks ago, and to be honest with you, I can't. It's one of the tragedies of old age. And so if I do repeat myself, it's just kind of in the space that I'm in and what I'm meditating about and thinking a lot about this summer. And we just got back from a week out in the mountains, and so lots of time to think and bike and all that kind of good stuff. I love that song, Touch the Sky, because I think it really captures a place of what Christianity is about, and Richard Rohr wrote a book called Falling Upward, and that's one of the phrases in the song. But the idea that we discover spirituality through our falling and failings more so than we do over our victories and the good stuff. And it is by falling upward that we discover grace. And I had a great illustration of that this last week. About 2 years ago, I was mountain biking out in Assiniboine Way. And there was about a 2 kilometer stretch going downhill after we'd done some climbing, and going down that, and my bike hit some loose rocks, and I had a really bad spill, like really bad, and I scraped up my side. I didn't actually break any bones on that particular spill. I have on many others, but just that particular one did. It just hurt a lot. And I went biking shortly after that, and there was a certain sense of that second thought in your head. I know if you've ever done mountain biking, but you really have to trust the bike and the process. And I wasn't. I was just going slower, and I was double thinking things. And you go over a particular rock garden or whatever, and the thought hits you, I could fall, and that could hurt. And I hadn't had that thought before. So I didn't bike as much, and then I bought a new bike this year, and I didn't use it at all. To my wife's chagrin, I'm reminded of this fairly expensive bike that I bought and I don't use. Because the idea of biking is really good. The actual biking hurt a lot. So it was, you know, and so a couple of days ago, I went out in Invermere, and there's some beautiful single track out there, and I really fell in love with biking again. It was a real gift. And I think that's a lot like spirituality. That sometimes when we are in the journey, we can fall, and we can get wounded, and we get bruised, and we can be in faith community and get disappointed. And sometimes we just check out and we stop going and we stop engaging. I've done it. Or you read the Bible and it's kind of like, you know, okay, I don't get that piece. And so you quit reading it. But then you engage again. And like one of those songs this morning just really touches your heart, and it's like, wow, okay, I can fall in love all over again. And I think there's a wonderful kind of analogy there. So I want to talk a little bit this morning around the idea of ego, and the premise of this, and it's kind of a little bit of a follow-up for what I did last time I was here, but the premise of this is that spirituality is, and I loved what, who's the worship leader this morning? Where are you? She's back there. I loved what you said. I can't remember. I don't know your name, but Alexander said, it's beautiful because poets, yeah, they do. They try to describe something that's indescribable. And when you communicate, when you're communicated, it's the same issue. We do our best effort in trying to engage and describe the indescribable, and yet we come back week after week and we're still missing. It's quite an interesting occupation doing this, especially when you get discouraging statistics that people only remember 7% of what they hear. And you're going, oh, really? So how do you make it memorable, etc.? So if I repeat, then I apologize for that in starting out. So here's a question for you. If somebody was to ask you, What's a Christian? What is a Christian? What would you say? What makes someone a Christian? Christ, okay. It's a part of an answer, I guess. What, like, if somebody says, okay, so let's just say somebody who's like, you know, completely unspiritual, unreligious, unchristian came to you and said, what's a Christian? What makes you Christian? What would you say? A follower of Christ. Is he going somewhere? Are you okay?
I would say I believe in God.
You believe in God. Okay. So believing in Jesus is the crux of that. That's what I hear. Yeah, okay. Although the Bible does say the devil believes in God, so does that make the devil a Christian? I'm just saying. You know, just think.
Relationship with Jesus.
Okay, relationship with Jesus. Okay. Okay. It's an interesting, that's good, simple. I like simplicity on the far side of complexity. But this side of complexity, it leaves something. Any other thoughts? Okay. So he's the Son of God and he rose from the dead, and believing in that would... Okay. And the danger with something that is just about belief, right? If I push that, and I know some of you are hesitant to answer this question at this particular point because you realize it's a trick question. I get that. But when you say, is it just believing? And you would, most of us would agree to the fact Christianity is more than just believing. Would that be an agreement? Okay. In other words, it needs to impact our lives, right? And it's difficult. And any definition of Christianity is, in a sense, incomplete, right? Because it's not just about defining it. It's, in a sense, it's indefinable. It's more than that. There's pieces of it that you can't just put into a nice, tidy package, right? And it's difficult to do. I think the Pharisees tried to trick Jesus into doing the same thing, which is the most important law, right? And then Jesus comes up with his famous quote in Matthew 22, where he said to love God, you know, with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as you love yourself. And all the law and the prophets kind of hang on that. And it's nice for us to know that we're not under the law, even that law. Interestingly enough, when you really get grace, that it's really about, you know, engaging and being loved and loved by God. So part of my premise is this, is that spirituality is not something that we're seeking. We are not spiritual seekers in that sense, that we are already fundamentally spiritual beings. And as John Vanier said, that spirituality is not so much seeking after God, rather it is about our humanity that we struggle with, right? So it is, how do we integrate spirituality into life? And when you define Christianity, and we try to do it on our church name, right? We have different brands of Christianity. We have different denominations of Christianity, different labels, and we have liberal churches and conservative churches and fundamentalist churches and, you know, Pentecostal, charismatic, and all kinds of different labels that we put on it to somehow describe the kind of Christianity that we are. And people would ask you questions like this: are you a born-again Christian? Right? Have you ever heard that question? You're born again? As though it's an option. Well, is there an unborn again Christian? Like, is that an option? It's like buying a car. Do we have air conditioning or don't have air conditioning, you know? And I would suggest to you that any of those definitions are by nature incomplete. So let's just play with this and try this on. What if Christianity is all of you, in all of God, in all of life? And all of God, in all of you, in all of life. That's all. See, that takes on a somewhat of a life journey now, because it requires all of you. And by all of you, that means all of you, right? That means your light side, the beauty of who you are, the parts that you selectively disclose when you come to a gathering like this, because you're all really nice when you're here. Right? We selectively disclose what we let people see about us. And how many of you know that when you leave here, or the people that are really close to you get to know the other side of you? Oh, don't pretend. Come on now. See, because we all have a shadow side, right? We all have that dark side to us. We all have that broken part of us that we don't let people know. I think of going to church somewhat like dating. How many of you remember the first date you went on? Remember that? Okay. The object of a first date, if you like the person, is to get a second date. Right? And there ain't no way you're getting a second date if they really get to know you. So what we do is we selectively disclose what they find out about us, right? And then 6 months later, they look at you and go, who are you, right? Because actually, that's the real you. It's just that you don't let people know that, because you can manage to a certain extent that shadow side. But when we stop managing it and we bring it into relationship, especially with God, then that's the redemptive process, right? So part of the challenge around defining Christianity, another challenge of it is really defining what the gospel is. And I think in many ways we have been trapped into somewhat of a misnomer about the gospel. And the gospel has been described, and I'm pulling out of old files here, but there used to be a way of defining the gospel as the four spiritual laws. I don't know if any of you remember that, the four spiritual laws. Some of you, you know, used to do evangelism and that kind of stuff. And it was defined as, you know, man is a sinner, man is broken, humanity is broken. God, of course, is love, and so we need to find our way back to God, and so Jesus is the way, which is why we come up with things like, you know, following Jesus, because he's the way back to God. And then the cross is that piece, and then we find forgiveness. That's the good news. And that was the way it's defined. And I think in some ways what that does is it focuses us on brokenness and focuses us on sin. And we find passages in the scriptures, like in Romans 8, where it talks about our flesh, or another translation says our sinful nature. And that becomes the focus, and somehow getting over the brokenness of us. And so we focus on the negative. And when that's phrased as what the gospel is, it's like defining Christianity. It's an incompleteness to it. And I think the problem with that is that it starts too late. So if our brokenness is the focus and getting over that is the gospel, and what you believe in order to do that, it starts way too late. And I would suggest to you that the gospel is really about understanding, and it starts with this premise, that each and every one of us here are created in the image of God. It is our God-likeness that we are. There is this creative impetus, and we reflect, we are the image of God, which is so loaded. So you go back to Genesis 1, 27, that God created us in his image. And male and female, he created us, which is why the gender, genderizing God, if you like, as male, or, you know, it just doesn't work, because God created the male and female. And so the masculine and the feminine are a reflection of God's heart, reflection of God's image, which says that we are social beings. It says that we are created with the need for relationship, with the idea of being loved and the capacity to love. That's a reflection of God's image. We are created with the capacity for that which is spirit and to engage in the spiritual, that there is more. This world is not it. There's more. And what's the more like? Well, that's the love component, and we are engaged in that. The challenge for us, of course, is that when our ego gets in the way of us engaging, when the idea of our broken, sinful flesh, whatever label you want to put on it, will get in the way of us engaging and being, if you like, restored to our God-likeness. Most of you didn't get up this morning, look in the mirror, and the first thing that came to your mind was, I'm created in the image of God. Right? And one of the pieces that that has happened for us, I think, in Christianity, and I think it is prevalent in church culture, is that when we see phrases like our flesh or our sinful nature or the fact that we need to die to self, right, we become very quickly, we kind of do a switch, that all of a sudden we become very image conscious. And the focus can become very much about our physicality. And we, because of the word flesh, so we translate that as something to do with our physical body. And so in our culture, the culture then becomes really focused on kind of a body image culture. So, you know, the whole industry around staying young and looking young and appearing young. And the idea of growing old graciously has somewhat dissolved in our culture. And we're always, and as, you know, as we get older, you know, those of us, we're all aging, but those of us that are now, you know, now bragging about how old you are, you kind of get to that point, that we just keep pushing it out. We say things like this. We say, well, 50's the new 30. Are you kidding? You know, or 60's the new 40. No, it's not. 60's 60. And it hurts. Right? Takes longer. Recovery takes longer. So you're only fooling yourself. And people say, oh, you look so young. Well, gee, thanks. But I am what I am. And the difficulty is how do we grow old graciously in a body-focused culture? And what it does is it feeds ego, right? And I love the writings of Thomas Merton, so let me just switch a term for a moment. Instead of saying sinful nature or flesh, let's just put the term false self in there. Thomas Merton is the one that described it that way. Or as Richard Rohr would say, the small self. I love that phrase. That it's our false self, that self that we project out there that really trips us up. And here's the danger is when the false self is unconscious, you think it's the real self. See, that's the danger. So when we really get attached to things, and if you pulled up in a Ferrari this morning and that somehow you're attached to that as your identity, that somehow that makes you special. Right, the Ferrari, regardless of who's driving it, what does it say about the person? Very little in terms of their person. Isn't that, you get that? What kind of suit you put on someone doesn't define them. Because the real self is not defined by the externals. It's not an outside-in focus, it's an inside-out focus. And the idea of, and this is the danger of Western spirituality. Western spirituality, I would say, is a very success-oriented spirituality. Does your spirituality promote you for success and help you look good? Right? Well, I don't think that that's why Jesus came. And Eastern spirituality is far more... and which is Jesus lived in an Eastern mindset, is far more inside-out focused than outside-in. And so when Jesus is saying things like, unless you die to yourself, to that false self, to the ego, to the sinful self, whatever label you want to put on it, you don't find life. You only find life by letting go. And so the two places of the real self in God that we find ourselves is that when we learn to practice non-attachment and non-resistance. And that's hard for us. In our Western culture, a lot of our culture is about attachment and about resistance. We have a lot of fight in us. We fight everything. We fight the war on drugs. We fight cancer. We fight sickness. It's a very aggressive, resistant kind of language. And we are attached to a lot. We are bombarded by images, body images, images of automobiles or dress or whatever magazine is bombarding you. And no wonder we have this challenge with a sense of what we phrase as a low self-esteem, because we are battered on every front, that in some way the message we get from all media is this, is that in some way or another you are not enough. You are not smart enough. You are not good looking enough. You're not skinny enough. You're not enough. You're not tall enough. We were talking to a young guy who was from Japan and raised in North America. And he always had this really low self-esteem because he wasn't very tall. He was about 5'5", 5'6". And he got, in his early 20s, he got to go home to Japan, where he's from. And his first thought when he got there, he said, everybody here is short. This is okay. And he discovered this place of being okay at 5'5". And if you're 5 nothing, you're okay. But you see, our culture doesn't allow us to be okay with that because it creates, that's what media does. Marketing does that. It creates a dissatisfaction that says in some way or another, you're not enough. And the voice in your head tells you that you're not enough. And if right now you don't think you have a voice in your head, it's the voice in your head telling you you don't have a voice in your head. Because you do. And it is constantly beaking off at you. And some of you do not just have a voice, you have an entire orchestra up there. You have a number of small groups going on simultaneously, right? And how does our spirituality, right? Man, if we got this, it would be. Now, if you get this morning, I think it really does bring a sense of freedom, because if we get that we're created in God's image, if we've really got that, that's the gospel. You are created in God's image to love and to be loved, to know and to be known, that you're worth knowing. Let me say this. You are right now worth loving. Now, I know what the voice in your head is saying. No, you're not. Because you goofed up last night. You had an argument with your kid. Right? You had an argument on the way to church. All of you had an argument on the way to church. It's the best place to argue. Right? And everybody, it's just part of the human condition. You get in the car to come to church and you're doing it together as a family. And because you don't often do that as a family, it's hard to mobilize people. So we often get into conflict coming to church. And then we come in here and we pretend that we didn't. And then we feel bad because we don't want to be hypocrites. And so I say, you're lovable. You go, no, I'm not. And that and many other stories take you out of the game. And so the imprinting that happens on our lives that takes us out of the game. The imprinting from your family of origin. Those imprints. Somebody asked me, when came in today, they were alarmed by the statistic I shared last time that if you witness, because I worked with the domestic violence unit up in Red Deer, and one of the stats I found out was that 85% of people that witness family abuse or family violence before the age of 5, 85% of them will become a victim of or a perpetrator of family violence. Why? Because of imprinting. Why is it so surprising? Here's the deal. 100% of us live out of a lot of those imprintings. Whatever you were imprinted with is in your family of origin from 0 to 12, you live that out. And when you live it out unconsciously, right? When you live it out unconsciously, it drives a lot of our behavior. Because what are we looking for? We're looking for that approval from mom and from dad. We want to be loved for who we are. And the people that are designed to love us unconditionally for who we are is mom and dad. So if dad dies when you're young, what do we internalize? That the person that's supposed to is not there. So it creates all kinds of stuff for us. If we're adopted, it creates all kinds of stuff for us. If there's divorce, it creates all kinds of stuff for us. And we live out of that. I still find myself living out of... My dad was a prof at university, and my mom was a nurse. And I was the oldest of two brothers in my original family of origin. And oftentimes... and I was raised in the 60s when there was a lot of turmoil about parenting. And there was a lot written about parenting and how you should parent. And it wasn't the silent generation of, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child. You know, there was still some of the residue of kids should be seen and not heard, but just some of that. But there was a lot of conflict around it. And my parents would often fight about how to raise me. Apparently, I wasn't a particularly easy kid to raise. Who knew? And when they got divorced and I was 12, I made up, right? It's not very far to go. I made up that it was my fault. Right? Because they fought about me. If I hadn't been such a bad kid, then they would have been fine. I'm trying to fix the parents, and we're still trying to fix our families. Trying to go back and somehow redeem them. And that imprinting on us creates that shadow place in all of us, and we all have our own story connected to that. And our spirituality is a lot of working that through so that the letting go of that, the ability to let go and to forgive yourself, creates for us the freedom then to accept God's love and to be loved. Because when we are attaching ourselves to the externals, it is compensating for the inner brokenness that goes on for us. The story was told of two monks that were walking along a road, and they came to a river, a small kind of stream. There was a young lady on the one side of the stream, and the older monk, the mentor, looked at the young girl and asked her, said, "You want to get across?" And he picked her up and he carried her across the river and put her down on the other side. And the younger monk was horrified by this because, you know, monks shouldn't be touching young women and da da da. Anyway, about 2 or 3 miles later, the young monk can't handle the angst that he's feeling about this inappropriate action that the older monk committed by picking up this young girl and carrying her across. And he said, "You shouldn't have done that. What was that about? I don't get that." And the older monk said to him, he said, "I put her down about 2 kilometers ago. You're still carrying her." See? And so we do. We tend to carry stuff that we don't need to. And the false self, the small self, gets caught up in the story and carries things and is attached to stuff. And one of the ways of embracing freedom is the ability, and this is an entire conversation separate from this morning, but is the ability to forgive and to let go and to forgive yourself. Because most of us in this room, if not all of us, have a black belt in self-defeat that lives inside of us. Hello? Right? I mean, who's hardest on you? You. Right? As hard as you think other people are, we can take ourselves out of the game like that. And so one of the ways, let me just read this in conclusion. I'm looking at the time. Let me just read this. One of the ways that we know that we're in the true, because it's hard to know if you're in the true self, if the self that you're created to be in God, right? So the true self cannot really be hurt or offended. It's only the false self that gets offended. Somebody cuts you off in traffic. Do you get offended? Do you flash them signals with one finger? Not this one. Right? Because when you take offense, that's not the real you. Because the real you cannot be offended. The real you in God cannot. The false self, our egoic identity, is offended every few minutes. But if we notice when we take offense and what part of us is offended, this will train us to gradually reside more and more in the bigger truth of our real self in God. So we are created in God's image. All of you in all of God in all of life. And all of God in all of you in all of life. That is a journey to embark on as we become familiar with the wrestlings and we become aware, self-conscious in a way of self-awareness when our egoic false self gets in the way. When we are embarrassed, when we are, when we don't engage, etc. And we get into this space that we take ourselves out of the game. That's ego. When we're attached to things outside of ourselves, ego. When we're name dropping, ego. When we're offended, ego. And let's be honest about this. I've been around church culture for a while, and it's fairly interesting how easily people are offended in church. Hello? Right? Music's too loud, didn't like this song, didn't like that, you said this, or whatever. We can get really offended really easily. Right? And we play the I'm right game. You know, lots of little games that we play. But once we get to this place, and I want to end today the same way I ended last time. When we get to this place, when you understand, each one of us in our own way, that God is not out there somewhere for us to seek God, but he's right here. We are, as Paul said in Acts, in him, in God, we live and we move and we have our being. Our ground of being is love. And when we are grounded and rooted and established in love, as it says in Ephesians 3, we are rooted and established in love. And love is our way of being. We are loved and lovable the way we are right now. God doesn't look at you and go, not enough. God looks at you and go, man, you're freaking awesome. Think about that. God looks at you and goes, you're freaking awesome. Right? You're awesome. You know, God doesn't really waste superlatives. Well, the Bible doesn't anyway. I always think it's interesting that we've gotten a point in our culture where we've run out of superlatives. Because, you know, you watch a basketball game and some dunk is awesome. No, it's not. You know, God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days and he goes, that's good. Right? So he doesn't waste superlatives on that. So if that's all good, right? I'm going, okay. But he looks at you and I'm thinking, God looks at you and he doesn't look at you as not enough. He looks at you as complete. And even in your brokenness, even with all of the other stuff that goes on in your life, he doesn't beat us up so that we come back to him, but he loves us. Right? It's like the old, parable where the sun and the wind have a conversation about getting the coat off the traveler. And the wind says, okay, I'll go first, and blows and blows and blows, and the more the wind blows, the more the traveler tightens the coat and holds on to it. And the sun comes out and says, okay, my turn. And just lights up the world and heats it up, and immediately the traveler takes the coat off. Discipline and punishment and fear don't bring us to God. Love does. I love the Rumi said this. He said this, after all these years, the Son has never said, "You owe me." Love. So right now you're loved. So let's close our eyes and let's just shut out the stuff that's around us. And I'd like the privilege of just praying as we close our time. God, in these final moments that we have together, may we become very conscious that we're loved, that we're enough, that we're complete in you. May each one of us discover our authentic, real, beautiful, loved self. And that we can walk in that today, we can be in that today, and that we can be aware of those moments of your love that surround us, whether it's a smile from somebody else within this community or a hug or whatever it might be. May we experience that. And may your love just, may we become so conscious of it and so aware of it. And then may we reflect it to one another in gracious, kind, patient ways. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand, shall we? May the grace of God and the love of the Lord Jesus Christ and the fellowship of His Spirit be with you. May you have an absolutely awesome, awesome week this week. God bless you.